All right, we're going to get started. Welcome. I'm Jonah Birch. Welcome to the second Brexit WTF.
Yeah.
We're lucky to be joined by Richard Seymour here, who I'm sure many of you know from his voluminous writings. How many books have you written?
I don't know.
Eight books?
Ten? Maybe. More like...
You know exactly how many you've written, to be honest. So the last one was Corbyn, The Strange Rebirth of Radical Politics, which is excellent. And you have a new one coming out called The Twittering Machine.
It is called that, yeah.
We'll have to talk about that. But first we'll talk about Brexit. Richard's going to speak for 20 minutes. And then maybe we'll have a little bit of a discussion, and then we'll throw it open for questions from the audience.
Yeah. Sounds good.
Okay.
So basically, I thought Brexit. We'll take the ISO meltdown, you take Brexit. How about that?
You don't want that.
No. All right. This talk has an epigraph. I've written a talk. This talk has an epigraph. It's from Octave Manoni, from his book Prospero and Caliban. And says, "The ghost of the former colonial subject haunts, without their being aware of it, relationships among whites who have never left Europe." So the other day there was a major survey by Hansard of public trust in Britain. And found the only major institution which retained the trust of the majority of the public was the armed forces. And this was released on the same day that footage emerged of soldiers in Afghanistan using Jeremy Corbyn's image for target practice. Now, there are a lot of murder fantasies in British nationalism and British politics today, and the DIY paramilitarism of people like Darren Osborne, who I think you know was the person behind the vehicular assault on Muslims on Seven Sisters Road, and other lone wolves, shows us that fantasy is formative of political reality. Recall that Osborne went to Seven Sisters Road in a hired van, psychically fueled for genocide. He said he wanted to kill all Muslims. But his first plan was to kill Jeremy Corbyn, a man he considered a traitor because of his affiliation with the Muslim. And he selected his ultimate target in part because it was in Corbyn's constituency. When he'd carried out his attack, he told police, "You can kill me now." Parenthetically, this is a peculiar feature of lone wolves post-2000. In the past, such attackers tended to survive, evade capture, and kill again. Now they're saying, and they're almost all saying this as soon as they strike, "Kill me now." Come back to that if you like. In Britain, there's a section of the population that's used to the consoling idea that men with guns can solve most problems. It's easy enough to identify this as a colonial idea, but it's also a very modern idea. The headline on the Evening Standard, London-based free sheet the other day, vaunted Prince Harry and Oprah, the television show. And this was actually on their part an astute bid for the Daily Mail audience, sort of... drawn to celebrity tittle-tattle and royalty. And it was basically, for Britain, the feudal rhapsody of princes and martial valour has taken on the character of celebrity. The ancient idea of fame as derring do, as male heroism, has transposed into a modern idea of celebrity, the condition that Daniel Boorstein famously defined as being famous for being famous. And so it makes perfect sense that Prince Harry can be 1 minute a military hero in Afghanistan, photographed looking buff in a jumpsuit, if that's your idea of buff, and the next minute teamed up with a billionaire icon of confident, glamorous Americana. You have no idea, by the way, how much pleasure and consolation British people can derive from that. It's a bit like that leap in the heart when a Hollywood film shows a familiar part of the British landscape and we thought, us, really? So it cuts against this deeply felt sense of decline, a declinism that is all the more resonant given that definite social strata, parts of the middle and working class is stuck with the remainders of what's called the old economy, geographically isolated, culturally isolated, economically isolated, and so on, really have seen their life chances decline for the last 40 years. Among the Brexit-supporting elements of these strata, who are the majority of them, There's a growing sense of outrage and despair. The language of treason is becoming ubiquitous. Everything is treason. Staying in the European Union is treason. Extending Article 50 is treason. A customs union is treason. Jeremy Corbyn is traitor number one. Don't worry, by the way, if you don't understand any of the terms I'm using here. These are terms that most of us in Britain had no idea about until recently. And we can talk about it if you need to. Jeremy Corbyn is traitor number one, having been helpfully framed as such by the Tories, the newspapers, the broadcasters, and even the odd military leader for almost 4 years now. But now, Theresa May, the Prime Minister, is a traitor too. Fully 42% of the public who express any sort of preference want the UK to leave the European Union immediately without any deal. They want out. Overwhelmingly, they want out of Britain that has become, as they see it, a soft touch for every sort of scrounger, cheater, bogus refugee, criminal, and jihadist murderer. Out of the Britain where public services are, they think, stretched by foreigners and wages reduced by people who shouldn't be here in the first place. They voted for an exit and they meant it. So the British state is in a deadlock. I think it would be worth it to briefly recapitulate the origin of that deadlock and that crisis so we can see where we are. So in the aftermath of the credit crunch, there was a general expectation of radicalisation, union militancy, polarisation, all the rest of it. That really didn't happen at first. What happened instead was sort of clinging to the centre, clinging to the honest brokers. And at that time, there was a big surge for the Liberal Democrats. I don't know if you've heard of those guys, but they basically are old news now. But at the time, they were regarded as honourable, decent people who could administer a difficult situation, you know, take the hard steps that would be necessary while making sure nothing too unfair happened. That state of suspended animation that followed the crisis seemed at first to have been broken by the student movements that broke out in late 2010. And then a series of public sector strikes against austerity, and then the Occupy movement, as small as that was in the UK. But it all passed remarkably quickly and to little overall result. The government, which was obviously a coalition of Conservatives and Liberals, felt able to persist with austerity. Labour stopped opposing it, gave up even any idea of opposing it, or indeed of addressing any of the major social questions raised by the crisis of British capitalism and the breakdown of representative politics which that crisis had catalysed. The result was that they tended to find national containers. These social questions tended to be contained within national struggles. So in Scotland, for example, the struggle of working class people against austerity, against dominance by a Conservative Party they never voted for, against the Labour Party's managerial rightism, was decanted into the radical wing of the campaign for Scottish independence. The result was that in 2014, the British state came closer than anyone expected to one of its national constituents voting for exit. This would have fundamentally weakened a political structure that suited the multinationals and the financial corporations very, very well, as well as endangering the military posture of the British state, since an independent Scotland would have refused to host the Trident missile system, which is, as you know, is leased from the United States. So it took extraordinary pressure, political blackmail, relentless propaganda from the BBC, and I really do mean propaganda, you have to see some of this stuff, and mobilisation of a huge cross-party offensive, including the Labour Party, to stop this from happening. Labour was punished for its role in combating independence by an electoral wipeout in Scotland in 2015. That crash was a major cause of Ed Miliband, then leader, of his humiliating defeat in the general election because the losses in Scotland wiped out any of the gains that were made in England and Wales. It also took out a huge swathe of Labour's traditional right-wing power brokers in the parliamentary system because these tended to be MPs based in Scotland, the heartland of the old Labour right. So, ironically, that prepared the ground for Jeremy Corbyn's takeover. So you can already see that's the first tremor. The organisation of the British state, its legitimacy and the relationships between parties and their traditional class bases were all seriously disrupted. Second tremor, of course, is Brexit. Happened a year after Corbyn took the Labour leadership. And looking back on it, what's clearly visible is that just as the student movement was dying and the anti-austerity movement was running out of steam and the public sector strikes were clearly not amounting to anything, just at that point you saw a series of riots break out in English cities, not in Welsh, Northern Irish or Scottish cities, English cities. This was a distinctly English phenomenon because those other places have devolved administrations where local parties can run who aren't the Conservatives. So anyway, and it was triggered in the first instance, these riots, by the police murder of a guy called Mark Duggan in Tottenham. Duggan was a young black man whom they had falsely alleged shot at police first. He didn't have a gun. For weeks, these riots systematically overwhelmed the capacity of police to control them. And bear in mind that police were, at the time, in the middle of an institutional crisis, which was caused by their exposed collusion with the Murdoch press in what was known as Hackgate. Basically, they were leaking all sorts of data and information to the press and getting favourable coverage in response. That was an alliance, by the way, that was formed in class struggle. An alliance between the Murdoch press in Britain and the police was formed during the print workers' strike, when the police took the side of the Murdoch Empire and helped break the strike. And a lot of the corrupt connections were formed around that time. Anyway, the public response was increasingly in favour of violent repression. Most people concluded that the rioters were taking the piss, that the authorities were being too soft. Calls for sending in the army, using rubber bullets, using live bullets, deporting them, send them to Afghanistan. I don't know why send them to Afghanistan, but that was the basic, that was quite a common call. There was also a racial panic involved, as you can imagine, but it was a very particular kind of racial panic. The historian David Starkey spoke for a lot of conservative Britons when he complained that the whites have become black. Think about how fecund that phrase is. The whites have become black, as though the very principle of racial distinction was disintegrating, an anxiety that would later afflict Thomas Mayer, the fascist who killed Joe Cox MP. In the period between the riots and Corbyn's leadership victory, you can look at it, almost every major political development took the form of a panic of some sort, usually a racist panic. Operation Trojan Horse was a panic about Muslims, radical Muslims taking over schools in Birmingham. It was all bullshit. A series of child sex abuse scandals, the newspapers focused on the ones involving Asian men and casually racialized the issue. Waves of panic about Romanian and Bulgarian migrants, then about Turkey possibly joining the European Union and sending millions of Muslims to Britain. Panic about Pizza Hut secretly feeding halal meat to Britons, thus covertly feeding Islam into the national metabolism. Meanwhile, in government, the centre-right conservative leadership...
Same in France, yeah.
God, it's way worse in France.
Yeah, it's way worse, but they did the same conspiracy.
Yeah. Meanwhile, in government, the centre-right conservative leadership was assailed by the most rebellious parliament in history, and it was mostly rebellious in the sense of Tory backbenchers repeatedly inflicting defeats on the government, largely to force it to take a harder line on Europe and negotiate stronger opt-outs from European rules for British businesses. This is not largely a politics of big capital, it's a politics of small capital and the outraged middle class. Don't underestimate the capacity of the middle class when they're mobilised. Not that you would, you've got Trump after all. Where was I? A major political force to benefit from all this was UKIP, and it didn't... UKIP didn't, of course, achieve any of its objectives by its own steam. It benefited from the collapse of competitors, such as the far-right British National Party. It gained from an extraordinarily credulous media, who were all too willing to believe that these fuckwits represented the white working class, or the left-behinds, and so on. And this was before, by the way, UKIP had broken out of its southern English middle-class ghetto. By 2015, the political dynamism was almost entirely in the hands of this minor player. The Tories were barely present in the campaign, and Labour was practically embarrassed by its own presence in the campaign. The result was that UKIP shot up to 12% of the vote, took 4 million votes, and the Conservative leadership felt compelled to prevent a party split by offering a referendum on membership of the European Union, a gesture that it was hoped would, like the Scottish referendum, kill the issue off for a generation. So you can see here, it's an attempt to reconcile the differing class bases of the Conservative Party, the outraged middle class, and the traditional sort of sectors of big capital, which are heavily integrated with European economies and commercial networks. Well, we all know how that went. How long have I got, by the way?
Oh, you're doing fine.
All right. Same coalition, same strategy, same Project Fear as in the Scottish referendum, the same vapid celebrities and uninteresting businessmen whom we were all supposed to hero worship coming out to tell us to keep the status quo. If you really want to see some insipid, uninspiring celebrities come to Britain, that can be our tourist strapline. A status quo that one has to remember really wasn't working for most people outside of the areas that were heavily integrated with European capital. The only difference this time was that the Labour leadership was a little bit more tactically adept, in that it kept deliberately aloof from the main campaign, which was run by the Tories in Downing Street. They refused to share a platform with the Conservatives, and they made sure that their position was sufficiently flexible that when there was a Leave vote, they could swiftly say, well, now let's have the result honoured and we can move on, that kind of thing. Anti-Corbyn Labour MPs at the time, as I think you know, responded by, in the middle of what should have been a major existential crisis for the Conservative Party, going on the attack against their own leadership. There wasn't much political coherence behind that attack, but basically they'd been holding off for a year, ever since he was elected. They had never intended to put up with Corbyn, a radical left socialist, as the leader of their party for a second. And they went on the offensive against him and against the members. They started suspending branches. They started expelling people. They tried to drive Corbyn out. They didn't succeed in doing so. They in fact, forced an acceleration in the learning curve of the membership. However, what they did was they temporarily weakened Corbyn. And they certainly usurped any political dynamism that was on the side of the Labour leadership. And they allowed the Conservatives a space to consolidate themselves. And what they did was they engineered an orderly transition from David Cameron, who was the now defunct leader, to Theresa May, who was a trusted Tory establishment person because she'd run the Home Office. She was regarded as someone who was a quiet Remainer, but who, because of her racist stunts at the Home Office, could connect with grassroots Tories and, you know, Brexiters. And so they made sure that she, because, you know, this will quickly become apparent. 15 minutes gone. All right, okay. Well, I'll squeeze it the rest into about 5 minutes.
Take your time.
Theresa May basically can't say the word hello without a script. She genuinely has a real problem with social, one-on-one, in public, whatever, she needs a script. When she has been doing her Brexit negotiations with opposition MPs, she reads from a script, always. So basically they didn't want to have her having to campaign for her job. So they made sure that her main rival, Andrea Leadsom, who was on the right wing of the party, a sort of Tea Party nutter, who would probably have won, they made sure she stepped down. I don't know what blackmail or incentives they dangled, but they got Theresa May in. They made sure that she never engaged in any one-on-one interactions or anything. It was always big set-piece speeches with the flags behind her and the big podium, and it would always be a sort of State of the Nation style address, and they tried to sort of make her look a bit like Mrs. Thatcher. And Tories have this sort of fondness for strict but caring sort of nanny figures, and that's essentially, they started to call Theresa May Mummy, because they felt that she was a suitably autocratic and, you know, they thought very sexually appealing kind of maternal figure. Don't doubt me on this. Just Google it, okay?
Paging Dr. Freud.
Yeah. Freud had nothing on these fuckers. Anyway, Corbyn weakened, and obviously, he stuck with a Brexit situation that he didn't ask for. This wasn't driven by the left; it was driven by a fight on the right. And basically, the Labour Party was split. It was mostly split on the parliamentary party. The majority of Labour members have a sort of bien pensant kind of Remainerism. You know, they kind of tend towards being pro-European because they're against Nigel Farage and the right and the racists and so on. But the parliamentary Labour Party is split between those who think the correct opportunism is to be anti-immigrant, and those who think the correct opportunism is to be pro-Europe. And that's essentially the division on the Labour Party backbenches. So Corbyn was forced to do something quite uncharacteristic for him, which was to prevaricate, to engage in tactical caution, to slip into a kind of aimless drift. The problem was that Labour doesn't have, and didn't then, have a macroeconomic programme that could sustain a hard exit position from the left, even if that was on the cards, which it just isn't. So they ended up with the lowest common denominator, which is soft Brexit, you know, like damage limitation, a position that, to be honest, I find it hard to criticise. After months of internal wrangling, worse, Labour turned against free movement, the European free movement system, to which it suddenly decided it was no longer wedded. That stance, by the way, represents a compromise with the Labour Party backbenchers, but it didn't actually work in electoral terms. Every single Labour electoral campaign that was run on the basis of trying to do a pale, wishy-washy version of Tory anti-immigrant politics, it failed miserably. They lost by-elections, they lost a mayoral election campaign in Birmingham that they should have won, they had weak local election results, and then, of course, as you know, I'm going to have to try and compress some of this. The Theresa May, 20 points ahead in the polls, thought, I know what I'll do. I'll ram home my advantage. I'll cash it in. I'll get these 20 points ahead in the polls and turn it into seats in Parliament. That way I can do whatever I want with Brexit. I don't have to worry about the nutters on the back benches. I don't have to worry about the left. I can do whatever I like. And Labour, you know, was looking at an election at that point, when it was first called, where in many of their northern Rust Belt seats, the combined Tory and UKIP vote, and UKIP voters were quickly bleeding back into the Conservative Party, was well over 50%. And the Labour had been hemorrhaging working class votes for like two decades. So there was a real risk here that this would have been a wipeout. I mean, I think you know the outcome was not that, but just to briefly recapitulate exactly what happened, Labour achieved with a class-based campaign, they didn't talk about Brexit very much at all, they didn't talk about immigration, they talked about class issues, a very narrow range of class issues, but nonetheless fairly relevant class issues, and with that they achieved a record swing in their favour, something that hadn't been achieved since 1945, got their share of the vote up from 30% to 40%. I mean, given what was ranged against Corbyn, the extraordinary campaign of propaganda against him, I remember he was connected to the IRA, a Czech spy of all things. Essentially they convoked another nation, a nation that we didn't know existed, and that indeed didn't exist until that snap election. And so everything that we're living through now is a result of choices made by the Conservatives in the aftermath of that traumatising and shocking wipeout. May had called the election, as I said, hoping for a supermajority with which she would rebuild the Tories as a powerful electoral machine. Instead, she had to make catastrophic compromises to keep office, because obviously Labour had just wiped out her parliamentary majority. She could only govern with the support of the DUP, and if you don't know who the DUP are, these are literally 17th century Protestant radicals. These are people who literally believe that they are engaged in a permanent and ongoing war with the papal Antichrist, and that the European Union is the papal Antichrist. The harlot of Rome, or whatever it was that Ian Paisley used to say.
The whore of Babylon.
Something like that, yeah. He used to call Rome Old Scarlet Harlot. So these nutters were brought into government, and of course their whole objective was, in order of priorities, first of all to preserve the Union, because as far as they're concerned, that creates a valuable polity, a political basis for a marginal Protestant community, a community of the faithful. that they can defend. So that's the first part of it. And the second part of it was to see if they could engineer a hard Brexit, like get out of the European Union without a deal, without any sort of customs union or any of that. And then maybe they could start doing deals with Donald Trump and, you know, freewheeling the old colonial style. Is it really? Oh, my God. Okay.
That's all right.
Yeah, no, but I'll try and wrap it up here. Anyway, that didn't work, obviously, and it was never going to work. The only strategy that could have worked for Theresa May at that point was, in order to get a Brexit deal through the House of Commons and claim the credit for it, would have been to cut a deal with the Labour Party. But, of course, Jeremy Corbyn, they'd spent years demonising Jeremy Corbyn as, you know, a Marxist, a terrorist, and so on. And a traitor. And so they had basically made it impossible for them to discuss their options with the opposition party. And at any rate, Theresa May, in addition to being an appalling communicator, is incredibly dogmatic. Like, once she's decided that this is her approach, she will not change her approach. And that's what we've seen. She kept coming back with this deal that she'd negotiated, which was an awful deal, a deal that, as Yanis Varoufakis put it, you would only take if you'd just been defeated in war. But that's because they sent over a bunch of right-wing lunatics, David Davis and Steve Baker, to negotiate with the European Union. They had no idea what they were doing. They thought it'd be a bloody cakewalk. The European Union would go, oh God, the British, we can't have the British walking away, and they would just give them anything. It didn't turn out to be like that. They also thought that the old Commonwealth countries, India, would be lining up out of sheer gratitude to cut deals with British capital. Turns out India doesn't give a fuck about British capital. They're embarrassed by the Commonwealth. They see it as a relic. So none of that worked, and Theresa May came back not once, not twice, but three times. One, two, three many Brexit deals, and with the same deal, and was beaten three times, humiliated. I mean, anybody else who'd been put through this would have resigned. Alas, if she were to resign, general election, Jeremy Corbyn and Downing Street can't have that. So that's where we're at. I'll just conclude with this note. I've talked a lot about the myths of British nationalism. British nationalism is not the only mythic form of politics. The hard remain tendency in British politics, dominated by the professional middle class, run by the political centre, is beginning to assemble serious forces. We should remember what myth is. Myth, as Bart put it, is depoliticised speech. As Karen Armstrong tells us, it connects daily reality to a level of experience that is divine, not historical. Europe is its own myth. The flag of the European Union, you may not know, like many images of Europa from the Reformation onwards, alludes to the woman of the apocalypse in the Book of Revelations, crowned with 12 stars. If you don't believe me, look it up. If the idea of Europa as a queen in struggle with the Antichrist sounds rather Paisley, first of all, and second of all, rather antiquated, one need only look at the reaction of leading European politicians, not UKIP, to the idea of Turkish accession. Look at what Sarkozy et al. Were saying about that and about the distinctly Christian heritage of Europe and the incompatibility of even a liberal Muslim state with union membership. Thus, antique religious myth fuses with the modern liberal myth of a Europe embodying enlightenment and progress, and whose bloody histories are aberrant or imposed upon it by external forces, and whose bloody borders are somehow humanitarian. This is a version of Europe to which the Brexit right is actually militantly loyal, and the predicates of which the hard remainers don't even know how to unpick. It is not an alternative to nationalism, but complementary to it. And that's the problem with Brexit and the whole debate. It remains what it always has been, an argument between two factions of the right, two wings of nationalism, and paradoxical as it may sound, two forms of Europeanism. No one has as yet made the case for socialist internationalism, let alone what that might look like in practice today. Thank you.
So I'm going to throw it open, but I thought first if I could ask you a few questions. One thing, maybe you could just give us your ignorant American audience an update on the current situation. My understanding is that the Europeans have now extended the deadline for a deal to October.
Yeah.
And that Theresa May has promised to go once a deal is reached. That she said she's not going to head the party in the Conservative Party in a new election. And there's a there's now Nigel Farage is back. I've also with something called the Brexit Party, which will run in European elections, which are happening in May, late May, something. So, do you want to say something? Who's going to win the next general election? That's our real question. Is Jeremy Corbyn going to win? Is he going to be the next prime minister?
Could easily. I mean, in the recent polls, you may have noticed that there was a split in the Labour Party, about 8 or 9 MPs, and there was a moment of panic and everybody thinking, you know, and a lot of supposedly left-wing MPs going, oh God, we need to keep these people on board. Let's just make any concession we can. You know, within a few weeks, they're down to 1% in the polls. Labour's at 41%. The Tories are down at 30-something percent. I mean, it varies depending on the polls, but basically, Labour has an average lead, I think, recently of about 3 or 5%, between 3 and 5%, which is quite a reasonable lead. And outside of an election, is quite telling, because what we've seen from Corbyn's leadership is that when he's not campaigning, he's a bit aimless and, you know, like, trapped by office, and, you know, he's not particularly good at, he's not the charismatic type, so he's not good at commanding the media landscape. And to be honest, actually, I'm glad that he's not that kind of person, because what he's good at is actually what's necessary. But, yeah, so if there was a general election campaign, it certainly couldn't be exactly the same as in 2017. Yeah. To have a different manifesto. Mm-hmm. Certainly, I think we'd have to have more on climate change. That's becoming more of an issue.
Sure.
We're having school strikes in the UK over this. And there's a whole series of other things. There would have to be a much more radical economic agenda. But I think it's quite probable that the cultural energies are still there that would sustain a victory. But just to say about what's going to happen in the next few months, the real question is what's going to happen to the Conservative Party, because, as you said, Theresa May's got to... I mean, basically, what she was told after she fucked up and called that general election and lost her majority... They said, you're staying on until you've seen us through this shit, and you'll eat all the shit associated with it, and you'll put up with all your colleagues knifing you in the back in public, and you'll do nothing about it, and you'll not complain. And then, once you've seen us through it, then you can fuck off. And she, out of a sense of duty, in part, has masochistically continued with this. I mean, any other person would have just said, fuck it, I'm not doing this. Because there's no way to unite her party base. No way at all. I mean, she's going to have to come up with a deal or some sort of repertoire of options or deals that could pass, that could get the support of both moderate Tories and the majority of the Labour backbenchers and so on. And that's a tough sell, but it's possible. It's certainly more possible than getting a deal that could unite Ken Clark and the DUP.
Right.
You know, I mean, that was
the
never going to happen.
The far right, you mean. Yeah.
DUP, far right, and the European Research Group run by Jacob Rees-Mogg.
Right.
The thing is, who could replace Theresa May? Because there's no obvious candidate apart from... possibly Boris Johnson, which is the candidate that the Brexit right want to impose, largely because they realise that this, you know, the first stage of negotiations, just to be clear, is just the terms of the divorce settlement. There is then going to be a longer negotiation over the future relationship between the British state and the British economy and the European Union, and that's probably more important. And the whole sort of argument about the political declaration, in other words, what are the priorities in those negotiations, is very important for that reason. They want Theresa May to see some sort of deal through, and then they want to get their guy in charge of the negotiations and basically look for a set of arrangements that will enable them to slash taxes, slash regulations, drive wages down and compete on that basis. I think that's a crazy strategy for capital accumulation in Britain. I mean, that's nuts, but you're talking about here a form of middle-class politics which, insofar as it has support of capital, is largely venture capital, sort of financial boutiques, you know, the sort of cowboy wing of capitalism.
Yeah.
So I think that's broadly, you know, the state of crisis that we're in.
I actually, maybe people want to ask about the position of the British capital and all of this, and it'd be interesting to dig into. I got to ask about all the attacks on Corbyn. And
yeah.
I think I can speak safely for most of the American left when I say it's very difficult for us to accept that Jeremy Corbyn is like a big threat to the Jews of Britain, you know, but obviously yeah. The accusations of anti-Semitism have had a big impact, you know, and maybe not that big an impact since Labour's doing pretty well in the polls,
yeah.
But it's certainly been the kind of focal point for a lot of the attacks on him and for the split from the right wing of the Labour Party,
yeah.
Which I understand is not going anywhere.
Yeah, it's not.
But, yeah.
They've changed themselves. They call themselves Change UK, which amusingly is an acronymized as CUK. the anti-Semitism allegations. It's what you think. There are some examples of anti-Semitism. There is some blindness to anti-Semitism. There's some people who don't know it when they see it. And some of those people, unfortunately, are people who should have been handling the disciplinary process and like saying, oh, holy fuck, that's definitely anti-Semitic, get them out. You know, there were some cases like that. But the idea, I mean, these are like 0.00%
Sure.
That's what we're talking about here. The idea that Labour has become pervasively and institutionally anti-Semitic ever since Jeremy Corbyn took over is obviously a slander, and one that is predicated actually on a kind of weirdly philo-Semitic anti-Semitism. You know, you get this idea that like some people think they're not anti-Semitic because they're pro-Israel. You know, like those guys who think that Donald Trump loves Jews because he's pro-Israel. Fuck's sake. All I can say is that the traction that these accusations have within the Labour Party is due to a number of reasons. It's not because it has electoral traction. The Jewish population in Britain is about 0.5% of the electorate, right? And by and large, this hasn't changed their voting patterns. So I'll give you an example. In 2010, about 30% of the Jewish population voted Labour. 2015, that was down to 15%, and that was largely because Ed Miliband had declared outright for a Palestinian state. And, you know, I mean, I think you have to look at the class composition of Jewish populations in the United Kingdom. Probably a little bit more skewed toward the middle class than in the United States of America, for example. And more skewed towards the Conservatives for historical reasons, going back to the Thatcher era. But at any rate, Miliband's declaration for a Palestinian state cut Jewish support for Labour right in half. By 2017, Corbyn's support from the Jewish community was about the same, 15-16%. It was about 1 percentage point higher, which means it was exactly the same because of the margin of error. So it had absolutely no electoral traction whatsoever. What it did do was that it, and if you're, if you've got a dark sense of humour, you can see a certain laugh in this. It got the left sort of skewered on its own moralism. You know, it's nobody wants to be a racist, obviously. And everybody wants to be doing and saying the right thing. So, you know, that this sort of tapped into left-wing sense of, you know, first of all, of guilt, because obviously, you know, there are ways in which the British left has historically been racist, although this is not the predominant one. And second of all, a sense of, you know, like, of course, you want to be doing the right thing. We don't want to react to this in the way that the right would, which is with absolute contempt. I think that it's led to some, on the one hand, a kind of hardening up among the rank and file, which is like, in some ways, some of them have even gone a bit anti-Semitic in response to the allegations of anti-Semitism, in as much as they've started to like be dismissive of any and all allegations, and have started to resent Jewish criticism. That's a tendency. I don't think it's a majority, but it's definitely a tendency. And then on the other hand, this kind of absolutely craven wheedling, you know, this begging, you know, for the moral beating to stop. And we'll do anything. This sort of bootlicking position. I think that you know, there obviously have to be healthier ways to deal with this, but my intuition about this is that it would not have been as bad as it was if the British left had taken racism seriously for the past three decades, you know. I mean, basically, there was a reasonably good campaign done in regard to Islamophobia during the War on Terror era, right? And that won some gains, but the general refusal to engage with anti-immigrant racism in the UK on the part of the left, you know, the refusal to engage with race as a serious force, and not just as an illusion or some you know, like an individual prejudice, I think left us open to this. So that would be my conclusion on that. How does that relate to Brexit?
I just am interested.
Okay.
What's going to happen in British news?